Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio, brought to you by the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, in collaboration with the Women of Color Network and the African American Domestic Peace Project. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio is made possible by a grant from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Administration for Children and Families, Family and Youth Services Bureau, and Family Violence Prevention and Services Program. Now, points of view expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the official positions or policies of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio brings you rich conversations and education on issues surrounding domestic violence in African American and African communities.
Listeners, welcome to the Women of Color Network Hour, where we will discuss specific topics related to gender-based violence and its impact on the African-American community. The Women of Color Network is a project of the National Resource Center on Domestic Violence and is dedicated to ending violence against women of color and their families by promoting the leadership of women of color advocates. If you are in immediate danger or feel unsafe in your home or relationship, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233. Now, on to tonight's show.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Women of Color Network Blog Talk Radio Show Hour. The Women of Color Network, Inc. represents hundreds of women of color advocates serving in the trenches across the nation. We bring you information, data, stories, opinions, practices, philosophies, approaches, strategies, and years of experience. But most of all, we bring you informative live talk with a range of expert guests. We will take callers and will open our lines at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time, 7:30 Central Time. If you have a question you would like to ask our guests, please call in to 347-327-9611. That is 347-327-9611. And if you're listening and are in immediate danger, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 800-799-7233. That is 800-799-7233. My name is Tanya Lovelace Davis. I am the CEO for the Women of Color Network, Inc., and I am pleased to be able to introduce this show this evening and to, on behalf of Samaya Fire Coleman, who will continue with hosting the show this evening, and I am joined by her cohort, her connection, her co-host, Miss Alice. Miss Alice, are you there?
I'm here, and I'm glad to be with you this evening. Good evening, everyone. I'm Alice Lynch, and I am the co-host for this Blog Talk Radio this evening for the Women of Color Network. I am the board chairperson, and I have worked in this field for over 35 years, and so I am delighted to be a part of this conversation. I'm going to introduce our first speaker tonight. No, I'm not. I'm going to send it back to Shazmi Jackson, who's going to set the tone for what we're going to talk about this evening. So, Ms. Jackson, just take it away, honey.
Good evening. My name is Shazmi Jackson, and I am the program coordinator for the Women of Color Network, Inc. I will be framing tonight's topic for you by providing key statistics and background information for our show tonight. Tonight's topic will examine the experiences of women and men transitioning from prison into the community. Prisoner reentry is an important national issue and at the forefront of many current social policy debates. Bureau of Justice statistics show that from 1980 to 2008, the number of people incarcerated in America quadrupled from roughly 500,000 to 2.3 million. Of this number, nearly 600,000 will leave prison and return back to their communities. Two-thirds of these individuals will be rearrested within 3 years. This cycle of arrest, incarceration, and reentry has devastating impacts on all families, their partners, their children, and it leaves. And what it does is it creates vast challenges upon return. Data from a survey of 3,000 U.S. lawyers showed nearly two-thirds of them admitted that they would not knowingly hire a person with a criminal record, regardless of their qualifications. And most were willing to hire persons with minimal work experience before they would hire someone who was formerly incarcerated. In addition to employment barriers, the report showed many landlords would not enter into lease agreements with individuals when their background check revealed an arrest record, even if they were never convicted or incarcerated. Reentry challenges can be especially concerning for survivors who want to live a life free of abuse. A discussion done with female ex-offenders about their community reentry needs described that when housing plans or job opportunities fell through, they would often resort to returning to the home of the abusive partner or engage in criminal behavior such as exchanging sex for money or other desperate behaviors, which often led to drug abuse, other criminal activity, and quite often rearrest. For some survivors of violence, incarceration may be a result of attempts to protect themselves or to survive the abuse. Many battered women have said that it did not help when they reported their abuse to the police. In a recent survey, the National Domestic Violence Hotline, 28% who have previously called the police were afraid to call again because of the fear that the police would be violent towards them or threaten to arrest them or actually arrest them. 24% or 1 in 4 women actually reported that they were arrested when calling the police for help with a domestic violence or sexual assault incident. According to the Sentencing Project, the number of women in prison increased by 646% between 1980 and 2010, with the rate of increase nearly 1.5 times the rate for men. Alongside this gender disparity, racial and ethnic disparities continue to make their mark. Reports show the chance of women being sent to prison varies by race. As of 2001, the lifetime likelihood of imprisonment was 1 in 19 for black women, 1 in 45 for Hispanic women, and 1 in 118 for white women, which results in black women being incarcerated at 3 times the rate of white women. In the African-American community, the intersection of race and poverty have shredded the family fabric and increased the likelihood of reentry in domestic violence. This disproportionate lack of resources and limited options for safety and economic security add to the rising rates of incarceration for women of color. For immigrant women, fear of deportation may also surface. Numerous studies confirm that over 50% of African-American women report not having full-time employment at the time of their arrest, compared to 40% of males, and 60% of those receiving welfare have been subjected to domestic violence, and as many as 30% reported others being victims of other forms of violence, such as rape and stalking, as adult at least once in their lifetime. We invite our listening audience to join us in the discussion to examine ways to work together to create a stronger safety net for those transitioning from prison to life in the community. Now, back to our show with Allison Samaya.
Thank you, Ms. Jasmine. We're going to start out tonight. I'm going to do a brief introduction of Ashley McSwain, who is one of our guests on the show tonight. Ashley is currently the Executive Director for Community Family Life Services, an organization that serves homeless and low-income families and individuals, and is the former Executive Director for Our Place DC, a nonprofit that offered programming and resources to currently and formerly incarcerated women in the DC area. She's also the founder and president of Consultants for Change, a consulting firm designed to assist the emerging nonprofit to manage their projects, build infrastructure and capacity, and learn the art of writing successful grant proposals. Ashley is a licensed social worker and holds a Master of Social Work from Temple University, a Master of Organizational Development from American University, and a Bachelor's in Criminal Justice from Temple University. She is certified as a domestic violence counselor and is qualified to administer the Myers-Briggs type indicator. She has worked in the human services field for over 25 years and is currently an adjunct faculty at Montgomery College, teaching nonprofit management and teaches grant writing for Maryland nonprofits. Ashley served 6 years as a probation officer in Philadelphia and additionally for 10 years while working as deputy director for the Bucks County Housing Group. She oversaw the simultaneous management of 5 homeless shelters and 3 transitional housing programs, one for women who were victims of domestic violence. Presently, Ashley manages a contract with the Justice Grants Administration and works with the Department of Corrections to offer case management, release planning, and navigation services for women who are returning home from the correctional treatment facility. She also facilitates trainings and workshops to inform community-based providers of effective strategies for working with women and have been to prisons and jails to offer this work. Additionally, at the core of Ashley's work is ensuring that the lived experience of women who she serves is in the forefront of programs and projects she manages. We'd like to welcome you to the show this evening, Ashley.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Did I miss anything that you think is important for folks to know?
No, that was a mouthful.
Great. Tamaya, have you joined us yet?
Yes, I am. I am here. Good evening to everybody. And tonight we also have with us for our conversation Marissa Alexander from Florida, from Jacksonville, Florida. A lot of people know Marissa as a survivor of domestic violence and a survivor also of violence from the criminal justice system in Jacksonville, Florida. And you also know her from the Free Marissa Now, Free Marissa Alexander mobilization campaign that was held on her behalf while she was serving time in prison. I am not going to do a long introduction of Marissa because Marissa, I feel, can speak for herself and introduce herself with her own voice now since she is able to do that. And we are so fortunate to have her, and I want the audience to hear her voice. So, Marissa, we're very glad to have you on the line with us tonight. And if you would share in your own way, your own introduction to...
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. I think my introduction is going to be equally as short because it doesn't need to be that long. I'm just grateful that I'm finally able to be a part of these type of discussions. This is obviously something I've always wanted to do, and as time winds down for me on the probation that I do have still, I'm just setting things up to be able to catapult once I do complete those requirements. So I'm excited to be a part of these type of discussions because this is something that I'm passionate about, and I'm grateful to be in the company of such advocates and leaders and these people on the show, these women. It's awesome. Samaya is awesome. So I'm just grateful for the opportunity that you all played to be a part of this and the role you played in helping me, my case to get out, for information to get out, and allow for my story to get out, and so people can identify, and therefore we can continue these type of discussions. So I'm just grateful that you know, I even though I wouldn't want to be in this position that I am, and I have an insight, and now I have a voice to be able to come on the show and be able to speak to your audience and be a part of this very important discussion.
Thank you so much. We appreciate you being on the line, and we're going to start our conversation tonight. Ms. Alice, do you want to lead us with our first question?
I sure will. We are fortunate to have the two of you on the show tonight, one who's working in this area and trying to assist women coming back in, and one who's lived the experience and can share stuff with us based on her own experiences. So to get started, Ashley, I'm going to ask you if you can describe ways that the experience of domestic violence impedes or impacts a successful reentry.
So one of the things that does happen when a woman is a victim of domestic violence and she's returning home to the community is that it impacts where she can live. And, you know, with the lack of affordable housing and her inability to go back to where she was living prior to her incarceration, and when she isn't able to go back to where she used to live, either because it is where she used drugs or it's because where her abuser lived, it also disconnects her from her support systems. It impedes her ability to be connected to her family. It makes it makes her feel isolated and alone. And those are the triggers that often lead to recidivism, relapse, or new charges. And so, you know, domestic violence plays a significant role when women are coming home from prison and they really are trying to identify a new system of support.
Thank you. And Marissa, is there anything you might want to add to that question, something that may be a hindrance when you're trying to come back into your own community once you've been incarcerated?
I've experienced you know, from a standpoint of things that they do have in place, or depending on what your circumstances are, once you reenter society, what I've seen is if they have some type of a community control or probation, although there's things, you know, set up to supposedly help and assist, it really doesn't. And what I have found is they've been counterproductive in helping the person to be successful. So I'll give you an example because I just seen it this week. You know, you had, you know, people on community control, which would be some type of monitoring device depending on the level that they have. And just if they have a situation where they can't pay their fees because they can't get a job, because sometimes you have to pay fees, then that can violate your probation, thus putting you back in jail. And to me, it just really doesn't make any sense because you're behind the eight ball because you can't get a job because of the conviction that you have, and then it'd be expected to pay fees, and then if you can't pay those fees because you can't get a job, then you're right back in jail. And to me, it just serves no purpose whatsoever. And then what ends up happening is the taxpayers end up fitting the bill for all of this, because at some point they need some type of something goes on, and like she said, they have, you know, they catch another charge or things like that. So that's just some of the things that I've seen to speak to that point.
So Marissa, in your situation, it was a little bit different. And you said earlier you're, you know, winding down your time for your probation. And for those people who do not know your story, could you say a little bit about what your situation is with your probation and how that fits in for you in terms of, okay, so now I have these community controls and what things are required of you?
Yes. So one of the part of my conditions for the plea that I accepted was that I, you know, had to do the 65 days, which I completed that at the end of last year, the beginning of this year. And so I also agreed to 2 years of community control. And for most people, I'm on level, I believe it's level 2 community control. And what that is I have a tracking device on my ankle and a little thing that I have to take with me It's always, it has to be within a certain amount of feet to get, you know, for it to register or whatnot. And so weekly I go in and visit my probation officer, and I write down a schedule, and there's an hourly from, you know, 12 to 12, and you're supposed to put down your schedule and you turn it in every week. And so I, the way that mine was set up, and this is kind of what the state attorney wanted, was that, you know, I'm not able to terminate mine after completing successfully a year on it, which there, you know, from what I understand by law, you can ask for it to be terminated. But for the way mine was stipulated, I am unable to do that. Any changes that I want to add to, I have to go back before the judge. A lot of people on it, they don't have to necessarily do that. Only thing they can do is go back before the judge if they haven't had any violations, and they can cut their time in half and terminate early. So that's basically what I have. I have about, I would say next month would be one more year left on it. I'm just grateful that, you know, when I, the other condition that the state wanted, which was another two more years of probation after that, that the judge did not give that to me because I did not have a prior record. But that's basically it. And so I just have to, I mean, you know, you have this device on your ankle, you shower with it, you do everything with it. This is part of my leg, unfortunately, right now for the next year or so. But it's very limiting in the sense that, it, you know, I mean, I could be stuck in traffic or anything like that, and that could be an issue. I was kind of really scared when I came back home on it, but I'm going to tell you what what is really going to probably shock you the most. I, as a part of that plea deal, I agreed to that because I needed to guarantee my kids that I could be home. But more importantly, what I didn't want is for my abuser to say that I was anywhere near him, because he still lives in the city. And so what I didn't want is for a situation where he to say, well, she was here, she was there, she was doing this, because, you know, he that's the kind of things that he did. And so I didn't want to put myself in a position where, you know, he would do that, and then what they do is they really investigate it. He writes a statement, I go in jail, I violate. But with this ankle monitor, he can't say, well, she was here or she was doing this, because it tracks everywhere I go. So honestly, for my safety, that was one of the reasons why I did it.
So Ashley, for a different there's a different situation for each individual returning to community from prison in terms of what their conditions are. Do you experience women in situations that are going back to work, if they can get a job, going back to work, and they have all of these restrictions that they have to, you know, be under, and how that impacts them, such as having an ankle monitor and you're at work. I can't imagine being on a job for myself. I don't have that experience of having an ankle monitor or these conditions that I have to be under while I'm working. What are women saying about that?
So coming home following a period of incarceration does put a lot of restrictions on women and their movement. And, you know, we find a lot of women that they get rearrested, but not because of any new charges. It's because of technical violations, like they didn't pay fines or they didn't show up on time to see their PO, or they didn't get employment, or they, you know, couldn't make an appointment because they didn't have any money. So they're constantly in this space of this double-edged sword. They can't get forward because they, you know, they don't have the resources to move forward, and they can't get the resources because they can't move forward. I mean, it's this constant, perpetual state of this effort to move forward, and you just can't seem to, and we see it all the time. But there's a difference between reentry just generally and reentry and dealing with domestic violence. You know, domestic violence adds a whole other layer of barriers that, you know, a lot of women aren't necessarily experiencing. You know, so if I'm coming out of prison and I'm dealing with someone who wants to abuse me, you know, that limits how I deal with my PO, that limits how I deal with my children, that limits where I get to live, where I get to work, on top of my felony and my probation officer. So it's, you know, it's a terrible experience when women are dealing with domestic violence. But in general, reentry is extremely challenging, especially when you have community service or when you have probation officers who don't really often understand the realities of what you have to deal with. You know, you can't always get to the PO at a certain time, at a certain date, because you don't have any money. You know, we have women that work with us sometimes, and a PO will call and say, I need you to come right now to give me a urine. Well, she had work, you know, so you have to have knowledgeable and informed employers who are willing to, you know, really allow those kinds of concessions. I do, but not many employers.
Great. Let's go move on to, we started to talk about it a little bit, but what about the system itself, the system, and especially the system that's supposed to be supporting victim services? How does that impact reentry experience?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, Ashley.
The system of victim services is very interesting in that, you know, if I'm someone who's in a situation of domestic violence and I beat up my man because he beat me up, a lot of times the victim services don't want to deal with a woman who's a victim and a perpetrator. And, you know, so we have women who, you know, been beat up and fought back and who can't seem to get the services because, you know, they've been arrested for violence. And so that's sort of a catch-22 for so many of the women who are trying to navigate the system of victim services. I'm sure Miss Alexander knows that better than any of us on this call.
Yes. I mean, what it does is it makes you, depending on the you know, for me, it makes you not want to get involved with the police. A lot of people just endure it because they had an impact with law enforcement, or I'm sorry, not an impact, but some situation where they had to interact with law enforcement, and it wasn't a positive one. And like you said, where they had to fight back, you know, I mean, I can tell you literally as of last week, I know of a young lady who, you know, boyfriend went to her house. And he jumped on top of her car. He beat her up. The car, he ripped the front bumper off. And when the police got there, they arrested her at her own house where he was. They arrested her and him. He got out, and he had a lower bond than she had, but he was at her house. And they have, you know, they have records of this guy, which she's called the police, and he's damaged and vandalized her car. And, you know, she did try to fight him back, so both of them was arrested. But it was just, it's just really an unfortunate situation because, like she said, now she's a victim, but she's also a perpetrator as well.
Right.
I'm
going
to
stop
right for a minute because we're going to have to take a break, a little break. And we're going to come back and continue that discussion because I like where we're going, and I think we're hearing this more and more when a woman is both a victim and a perpetrator, and how she's treated in the system. So let's take a break, and we'll be right back.
To Sister Tanya Lovelace and the staff and advisors of the Women of Color Network, on behalf of Tony Porter, Bishop Freeze, and a call to men, all the men here want to say thank you. We want to recognize and thank you for the hard work and efforts to address and challenge the rights of women of color in the movement today. We just want to let y'all know we ain't got nothing but love for you. Nothing but love. This is
going out to all the women of color, from a call to being gay to well-meaning brothers. Cause we appreciate the hard work that you do, with all due respect, we just want to say thank you for challenging us all to be better people. Like Dr. King said, we all created equal, staying on the front lines of the struggle. Always do the rescue for women in trouble, for crimes like sexual assaults and DVs, eliminating violence on women and families, addressing human trafficking and police brutality right here in the United States, and that's reality. Well done, sister's job well done, for the call to action for each one, teach one. So from a call to men and all his well-meaning brothers, sisters, we ain't got nothing but love for you.
Okay, thank you. We're back, and we are talking this evening with Marissa Alexander and Ashley McSwain, and we're talking about what happens in the difficulty for women to transition back into the community once they have been incarcerated. This is also an opportunity for our listening audience to call in if you have any questions, and the number you should call is 347-327-9611. That's 347-327-9611. If you have any questions or comments about this discussion, please go ahead and call in. I'm going to go back to the two of you because we were talking about when a woman is seen as both a perpetrator and a victim. And so how does things work for her then?
Not very well. I mean,
what do you think happens? System responds.
Huh?
How do you think the system responds?
Well, not very well, because they have a lot of the victim services organizations have mandates where they can't serve a woman who's been a perpetrator. You know, they just can't. And so, you know, this very woman who's, you know, in need of support can't go to the system designed to serve her simply because she fought back. I mean, you know, it's a current discussion in the victim services industry, you know, to figure out how do you support that particular population. And it's organizations like mine and us that really try to figure out how to support her, but the victim services industry hasn't figured out exactly how to deal with a woman who's got that dual role.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of times, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead. Finish up. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, a lot of times these women who also, while they're perpetrators, they're victims, and they're in these institutions, and they are just not really able to get the kind of services and support that they need. I mean, they're in an environment that's focused on keeping the outside secure from them, and, you know, not really in providing them with an environment that's safe, you know, that makes them feel safe and secure. So it's a real hardship when you're living and dealing with that dual label.
So, you know, the dichotomy here is that, you know, while the victim and others see them as perpetrators, we see them as survivors who have defended themselves. You know, Marissa can speak about that as well as anybody who has been through that experience. And when we see the trend of victims being arrested, you know, with mm-hmm. the dual arresting that is going on, but, you know, and Marissa, I want to give you an opportunity to speak to that, but also want to talk about just insert here just a little bit about this initiative with the Department of Justice that happened on this Justice Week, where they have this purpose of guidance, these key principles in what they're calling the guidance. And there are like 8 principles, and one of those principles is for, you know, law enforcement to be more careful in identifying the perpetrator in domestic violence incidents. So, you know, there is so much that goes on in that situation when law enforcement arrive on the scene. And, you know, one of the statistics that Shazmi mentioned was that 28% of women who are not, you know, willing to even involve law enforcement because of the kind of things that they experience, you know, as a victim. So, Marissa, I know that you can speak to how it feels and what the experience is like in being seen as a perpetrator, you know, through the eyes of the criminal justice system, being, you know, really like basically hunted by the district attorney in this situation, because she said that you were angry and not afraid or not fearful for your life. So can you expound a little bit on that?
Right. And listen, you know, I just don't really beat around the bush. That's the reason why I've had to be quiet for so long, because it's just not my style. So here's the thing. If you're in a situation where you're getting physically assaulted, you're going to be scared and fearful, but you're going to also be angry that you're getting beat up on. I mean, to just say that that was the sole purpose to me is just really silly. So of course you're going to be a little, I mean, I will be mad if somebody's beating on me and shouldn't be doing so. And so that makes no sense to me, but also in that anger, being in fear, obviously, because you don't know what the outcome is going to be. What my experience has been is that, depending on, how the person calls the law enforcement is kind of how they react when they get there. There's also this attitude of, you know, well, they're probably just, you know, some, you know, two to whatever fighting, and she probably just went off, and that's how that goes. The thing that bothers me the most about it is because I'm in, you know, law enforcement, the judicial system is labeled as a violent offender. I'm not a violent person, and I never have been. So now, because of this situation and that pursuit, that's what that label has been on me. And so the ironic thing about it is that my abuser was a violent person and had a violent history of abuse, you know. And so it's just, you know, just the thought of going into it and you looking at your screen as a police officer and you're seeing this person's name because you have all their arrests and you see what those arrests are and you see that there is a restraining order in place and you make the connection somehow that this particular one, because I guess it's eyewitness testimony, that, you know, okay, well, this is what necessarily happened. And so at that point in my incident, there was no further due diligence by the police officers, and there was probably a good 10 or 15 of them there. But there was no due diligence to say, okay, I just spoke with Ms. Alexander, let me go in this room, let me go and do this. That, none of that was done. And so then at that point, you lose so many things that could help you because at that point, there's no more work done, and so you're labeled, and then there you go through the system.
Yeah. One of the things that the system does is that they sort of separate, you know, they separate in terms of good battered women and bad battered women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the good, you know, victim, bad victim. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, and it really is, mm-hmm. you know, like, I'm not sure what that's about, but that leaves some women who fight back and who are angry and aggressive and frustrated, you know, in the camp where, you know, it almost appears as if they've initiated the, you know, the violence because they're angry about it. And, you know, that's part of the systemic problem with domestic violence is, you know, like sometimes we as providers put the women in these camps and, you know, it really is false. You know, there is no truth to what makes up a good victim or a bad victim. You know, people are victims.
Well, you know, part of what that is about too, Ashley, is about who's going to get services. You know.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's some of that. You know, who's going to get services, and some of what that is about is who's believed. You know, so.
Well,
wow.
And that's at the core of this issue of services and systems. You know, I mean, we want the nice, pretty looking victim, and we want to allocate our resources to that one. you know, this is ugly. This, you know, system of victimization is it's very ugly. You know, women, some of them are prostitutes. Some of them are addicted. Some of them are criminals. It doesn't. It has nothing to do with their victimization. And I think a lot of people don't really understand that. You know, there are no pretty victims. You know, they're just victims.
Right. Exactly. So, you know, I was going to get on my box about dignity and, you know, integrity and all those kind of things, that regardless of the situation, the victim still needs to be treated with respect and
right.
all of that. But Miss Alice, before I go there, I'm gonna check in with you to see if you have any more questions, because you know where I'm going with this. So, you know.
Keep going, honey. I'm right here with you. Keep going.
You know, yeah, I mean, it's like, is victims, you know, let's say survivors of domestic violence, persons who experience violence in their home, cannot get treated with respect and dignity, you know, when law enforcement shows up on the scene. And then they're not treated with respect and dignity when they go through the system. What makes us think that they will be treated with, you know, dignity and respect when they are returning back to community? And that was one of the reasons why we were so adamant in our mobilization campaign for Marissa Alexander, because it was, you know, hey, we were saying she will not be forgotten, she will not be erased, and that we wanted to demonstrate, you know, restorative justice. What does it mean when someone who has experienced this kind of violence from the system and in their home, what does it mean? How do we restore them back to community? How do we help them get their lives back on track? And so that's why this conversation is so important, because, you know, we've got so many women of color, so many black women in prison, hopefully who are going to be released at some point. And when they come out of prison, we want to be able to help support them to get their lives back on track. We've got so many women now who, you know, women of color, who you see that are being treated, you know, with disrespect, with disbelief for all. Let's start first by believing them. But when you look at the survivedandpunished.org, www.survivedandpunished.org site, and you see all of those women who are on there who defended themselves against domestic violence, and looking at 20 to 60 years in prison, we see a trend here. And so what we want to do is to definitely have some kind of, you know, things in place for women who are going through the system, and for women who have been incarcerated, and for women who are coming out of prison.
So can I just say that, to your point of this issue of dignity and respect, that's at the root of reentry just in general. You know, I work with women, and, you know, some of them are treated so poorly, and because they're treated so poorly, they won't go get the services that they are being offered. You know, I have sisters tell me, I'd rather sleep on a bench than to go to some program because they've been treated so poorly. You know, that is the real unsaid barrier to reentry, is this the fact that the social contract that we all have agreed to allows us to, you know, mistreat this population simply because we think that they've done something wrong, which then allows us to be, you know, to judge them. And, you know, it permeates this system, and it is a huge barrier to someone's success. They already feel terrible enough. And to walk into an organization that really sort of confirms that they're worthless, you know, it's a big, big challenge, one that very few people are talking about in terms of reentry barriers.
Well, you know, I really appreciate you saying that, and that really is the impetus for our work at the Women of Color Network. You can go to our website at www.wocninc.org, and you can see the work that we've done over the past 15 years in trying to develop leadership among women of color to address those kind of things that are happening with our community. Nobody can say that better than us. Nobody can tell that experience better than us.
And so over all these years, we've been saying, hey, we are the leaders of this. You know, we can say this. We can say this better than anybody and tell this experience. And so it's sisters like you, Ashley, and Marissa, you know, who can get on this call and talk about this from a vantage that tells our story. And we are in the background across this country, state to state, city to city, neighborhood to neighborhood, building programs that are culturally relevant, that are specific to the ways in which we experience all of this. And again, nobody can deny the work that we've done. Nobody can deny that we are out there on the ground all over this country trying to make a difference for women of color. So, Ms. Alice, you know I'm on my soapbox tonight, and it's probably because we're at the end of the year. Well, I'm going to let you go ahead and ask another question because you know I'm on a roll.
Good questions, and it needs to be asked. It needs to be addressed. You know, I, too, recognize that we have been blessed tonight to have the two of you on the air because these are the kinds of things that we keep hearing, those of us who are advocates and work in our communities keep hearing and keep talking about and just don't know where to send people, what direction to even get them started to have some resources made available to them. So the thing that I'm thinking about, and we're already talking about it, so it's just to think about, we've talked about all the negative stuff that goes on from a reentry standpoint, and especially, and I'm addressing African-American or women of color, what are some of the strategies that we need to make sure in place to make sure that there is a successful reentry program for our women? Ashley, why don't you start out?
So one of the strategies to successful reentry is to build a team of supports for women. You know, when you're reentering, there are so many things that have to be prioritized, and no sister can do it alone. So if you are running any kind of reentry program, if you're doing reentry work, then you have to put together a team for that individual woman. That includes someone who's dealing with her employment, her child care, you know, her probation, her housing, her mental health, her addiction. You know, like there needs to be someone who's helping her manage all of those things. And without that as part of the strategy, it's very hard to be successful. The other thing that's really important, at least in the work that I do, is that the providers that are, you know, initiating the services, is that they do some training on themselves, you know, understanding where your biases lie and where your values impede your ability to help these sisters. You know, those are the two spaces that I believe is where some of the energy needs to be, using a team approach and looking at self.
Mm. Hey, Marissa, what do you think?
Well, you know, I haven't had to use the services that are provided as of yet, only because, you know, I was very fortunate to have such a super great support system. But my experiences have been just dealing with, you know, the things that I've had to deal with on the probation. It's been you know, it's been a little, you know, challenged from time to time. One of the services that I use for the exchange of my daughter in that particular facility, which is basically a supervised exchange facility, I find that to be an interesting place to do those type of things. And so what I've found is a lot of, you know, women in situations. I've seen, I've probably been one of the only females that I've seen every time that I go up there. Most of them actually are males because we're considered the red. So it's, you know, things like that, that there's a service, but I, you know, I have some strong feelings about it. And since I'm currently using them and it's for my daughter, I'm going to keep it to myself. I just think that things like that and the people that work in those areas could definitely use, you know, some type of training and some, you know, because sometimes I think what you are feeling or your stigma or your, you know, maybe judgment or anything that may come off when you're trying to provide, you know, whatever service you're supposed to. And it is very uncomfortable for the person because it's already an uncomfortable position to be in anyway. It's not something that, you know, you want to have to do, but you have to do it and you have to use it. And a lot of times you may need to use it. So I do, you know, understand that side of it.
Great. Well, thank you.
Maya? You know, Ms. Alice, you talk about strategies. I mean, it just feels like to me there should be some kind of, you know, restorative justice approach to, you know, women coming out of prison who are victims of sexual and domestic violence, especially those, you know, who have been put into a situation where they have been, where they're really like innocent, you know, they're defending their lives and those kind of things, because you when you are in prison and you're in that environment, and you come out, and then there's this, you know, all this emotional stuff that you've got to deal with, the trauma of all of that. And while we're in this, you know, climate of talking about, you know, trauma-informed care, it's like, where are our strategies around trauma-informed care for those who are coming out of prison and returning back to community? How, you know, where are the services that really speak to, that address the kind of support that they need, a support system when they don't have, you know, loving families to come home to? Because a lot of times, you know, while you're in prison, you've been forgotten about, you know, or, you know, ostracized, or there are so many stereotypes and stigmas that are attached to that whole experience. So I think that should be a part of our strategies as well, community-wide.
Yeah, that is a part of the evidence-based approach that, you know, a lot of reentry programs are looking at it through the lens of trauma-informed care. And the women that we serve are, you know, they've said to me, we haven't dealt with our trauma. And I'm thinking, wow, you know that? And so it is an important strategy in order to figure out how do you need to communicate with someone who's been a victim of violence or who's had years and years of trauma that skews her perspective and her understanding and her ability to receive supports. So, yeah, that's pretty big right now
I'm also talking about the trauma of, you know, of the experience of being violated while in prison. You know, there's such a range of trauma that is experienced by that person overall. But so we're coming to a close for our conversation, and I think this is the time where we start to give, you know, both of our guests tonight an opportunity to say those things that, you know, you just really need to get out there and that you want people thinking about. From your perspective, what are some things, Ashley, that you would want folks thinking about for your last words? And then, Marissa, we want to offer you that same opportunity.
Well, one of the things I'd like to leave people with is that, you know, a lot of women who are coming out of prison are dynamic, wonderful, brilliant women who are looking for an opportunity to rebuild, and, you know, they're willing to go the distance and do what needs to be done. And, you know, just because some of them are, you know, not following the right pathway, not all of them are. And, you know, you won't find a better employee in someone with something to prove, you know. So our sisters are trying to figure out, you know, some opportunities for themselves. And so if you can make a way for them to prove that they're not the sum of their crimes, then, you know, I think women will, you know, come out of this this tragedy, you know, more successful, stronger. And I also would like to say that if you are a provider, you know, really look into what your biases tell you about how you do your work. You know, I can't tell you what your biases are, but if you take a minute and pause, I'm sure you might see that your values are influencing who you're serving and how.
Okay. So, Marissa?
Yeah, real brief. I just like to, you know, piggyback on what she said. I would agree. I think a lot of the women coming out, I know because I did time with a lot of them. They are very extraordinary, brilliant women. And what I've seen is that they usually are the hungriest because they know that they have to survive and they cannot go back. And so they will go the extra mile that your other people who, you know, haven't had the unfortunate experience of taking your most valuable asset, which is your time, and never being able to get it back, they will go the extra mile because they're so grateful and thankful for the opportunity. And those are the ones that I've seen and they work the hardest. And just the people that have given me a chance since I've been, I have since then created my own business. But the ones that did give me an opportunity were not let down because, you know, I outside of that situation, it did not make me who I was. I was always a smart girl and a hard worker prior to that, and that didn't change. It was just a circumstance. So I would encourage them to really, you know, feel them out through the interview process, give them an opportunity, and I believe that they'll work probably even harder than the employees that they actually have, but you have to give them a shot.
Yeah. Thank you to both of you for, you know, being our guest tonight. We really appreciate it. This has been a great conversation. It definitely has not been long enough. You know, there's so many other things that we really could have talked about, too, in terms of, you know, what it means to be a felon and the impact of that on, you know, long term in terms of not only employment, about employment, but also about being able to go back to school and have the opportunity to get grants and all those kind of things, too. But we'll do another show. We'll try to work another one in. So what I want to leave the listening audience with is to go to our website, wocninc.org. Look at our materials. Look at what we do in terms of developing leaders and enhancing leadership skills and those kind of things that we launch leaders across this country. Go to the website survivedandpunished.org and look at that information about so many women of color who are going through the system and the information that is on there about women who are experiencing violence in prison and all of those kind of things, so that you can be educated about why we are so passionate about the work that we do. And so, Ms. Alice, with that, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, I, too, want to thank everybody who's been involved with tonight's show. This has been a really great show and a great conversation, and we didn't stop talking. We kept talking. The only time we stopped was during the break, and that's a good thing. But just to let you two know before I sign off is that you have no idea how much I support what the two of you are doing and getting this information out, because for many years I ran a reentry program using restorative justice practices. And restorative justice means that we actually went into the prison, met with the people who were getting ready to come out about three months before they were released, and they developed their reentry plan. And it wasn't just a bunch of talking heads saying this is what you do, and we had parole supporting us in what we were doing. And we met with their supporters on the outside as well as their supporters on the inside. And the day they were released, we all met together. So, and I think, Marissa, you get that because you had that all along the way. So I just want to thank you for being with us. And we're going to end the show tonight. And this is the holiday season. And one of the things I want to encourage all of us to do is to think about paying it forward. This is a time where we can count our blessings and go ahead and try to bless some others. So have a great holiday season, no matter how you celebrate it. And we will be talking to all of you next year. Have a great evening, and thank you.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
Well, that's it for today's show. You've been listening to IDVAC Blog Talk Radio, right here every week at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time. IDVAC Blog Talk Radio is brought to you by the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community, in collaboration with the Women of Color Network and the African American Domestic Peace Project. Visit us on the web at idvac.org to find out more information about our guests and presenters, and to download podcasts of previous shows of IDVAC Blog Talk Radio. Until next week, be safe.